Have you had to deal with creeps at work? Did you feel like you could call them out for harassment? Today, we're hearing from a bunch of people who are trying to change the culture around speaking out on this stuff. Hey, Isabella Higgins with you on Hack. Now, when was the last time you went to a gig? Yeah, coronavirus has made it kind of hard, right?
You know, we're at 800 capacity standing concert venue that turned into really a 150 capacity cabaret venue.
Coming up, we'll take you into that new world of socially distanced live music.
Hack. Had an old man grab my bum during a shift. The owner even saw it happen and told me that he wouldn't tell the guy off because he's a regular high-paying customer.
On Triple J.
Anyone who has worked in a bar with lots of drunk people knows you can deal with some pretty gross stuff. But sometimes it crosses the line. A Sydney bar manager recently took a guy to court after he slapped her on the bum at work. She did it because she wanted to take a stand against harassment in the workplace. We know it's not uncommon in the hospital industry. In a sec, we'll be speaking to that young woman, Annabelle. But first, here's some of the stuff you guys have told us you've had to deal with while working in hospital.
Although I did really love working in hospitality, it was very common to go to work and be sexually harassed by the regulars or older patrons. I remember one night I worked in the restaurant and I was waiting a group booking, which consisted of three older couples. The men on the table made constant inappropriate remarks on my appearance and how it benefited the service whilst their wives sat there and made excuses for them.
I was wearing bright lipstick and a man said to me how he'd like to see where my lipstick would rub off. And as he was leaving, he grabbed me by the arm and pulled me outside to his car and showed me his dogs while never letting me go. He said to the dogs, "How would you like this one to be your new mum?"
I'm Arielle. I'm from Melbourne. I've had to deal with sexual harassment twice in the workplace, both times in kitchens. One of them was my boss inappropriately touching me. I was young and just laughed it off, like I didn't know if I could say anything about it. And the other time was at a different venue, involving repeated inappropriate comments about my body, you know, when I'd bend over to grab things from my fridge. You're basically just made to feel like you have to put up with it, otherwise you'll ruin the dynamic in the kitchen. It's all guys. Or, like, if you say anything, you're going to lose your job. So it's really toxic. It's completely put me off pursuing my career as a chef, and I've just abandoned that. Yeah.
I'm a 25-year-old bisexual man. I used to work in a gay bar, and we would receive, like, a lot of sexual harassment from customers who had too much to drink, but also in one instance from the manager. He came up beside me as I was working and groped my butt and then just sort of walked away without saying anything. It almost seems like a small thing, but the clear display of him asserting power over me, it really makes you feel shit.
So I worked at a really well-established upmarket-ish restaurant for over a year. Within a couple of weeks, I had an old man grab my bum during a shift. I told my manager and she just told me to ignore it because he's a regular. When it happened again months down the track with a different kind of like grotty old man, the owner even saw it happen and told me that he wouldn't tell the guy off because he's a regular high-paying customer.
Hey, this is Joe from Hack, actually. I wasn't going to put myself in this story, but it turns out I worked at the same restaurant as that last person you just heard and have so many similar war stories. So that just shows how common it is. And also we worked at least 5 years apart and it shows that nothing has changed.
There were like other girls who did leave after stuff like this happened to them. I stayed for the money, you know, you gotta do what you gotta do.
As a woman and server in that scenario, you don't feel like you can stand up for yourself because, like, you know, the customer's always right or whatever. It's so hard to have the courage in the moment to speak up when you're just overwhelmed with fear.
No matter how much I wanted to defend myself, there is a societal expectation for women to be compliant as well as the customer is always right mindset.
And I think it's important to fight that kind of stuff, like no matter where, and let people know that their actions have consequences and nobody is entitled to touch your body just because they want to. And that we're not going to take that crap.
I remember I once got slapped on the bum by a patron who was on his way out of the venue. I actually just rolled my eyes and shrugged it off as drunken behaviour. I told my boss about it later and he was horrified. He assured me that I always had the right to ask a customer to leave if I felt uncomfortable and said that he would never undermine that decision. It made me feel really empowered. And because of that, I've become a much more assertive person in these situations.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J.
Joe Lauder reporting there. Now, we're joined by Sydney bar manager Annabelle Basil, who took legal action against a patron who harassed her at work. It was in court last week, and a 41-year-old man pleaded guilty to common assault. Annabelle, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Annabelle, I know this isn't a nice thing to talk about, but can you tell us what happened to you?
So a year ago I was working in the pub and a man just pretty much walked in. I smiled at him because that was my job, to smile at patrons. And while he was on the phone, he just slapped my bum as he walked past me. I was working, so I had to finish up serving the customer I was serving, and then went back to him and told him that that was disgusting and that he couldn't do it. And he simply just turned around and justified it by saying that it was fine because he had a wife.
Already on the text line, we've got other people texting in, I had my bum grabbed while working and management did nothing about it when I complained to my bosses. Annabelle, I'm interested to hear, was this something that happened commonly at the bar you worked at?
So for me, I was fortunate in that I hadn't witnessed anything physical happen until this point, but I had seen or I had heard a lot of verbal comments objectifying the bartenders and just generally disrespecting the staff that were there. So this was the first physical thing, but it's definitely not the first one that I'd heard of.
And what made you want to take legal action in this case?
I was one of four of the managers, but I was the only female. And I worked with a lot of girls as well. And for me, I would just have hated if something had happened to them and they kind of thought, oh, well, Annabelle didn't do anything about it, so I'm not going to do anything. And so for me, it was about just leading by example and trying to sort of be the change I wanted to see.
And we've got another text on the text line. Someone says, I'm a male. I worked in a big pub in Byron Bay. I was constantly hit on by older adult women. I had my crotch grabbed and my bum slapped all the time. It is not just creepy old men. Now, Annabelle, we hear all the time that people, sexual assault victims, are sometimes hesitant to go to police. I'm interested to hear, what was the experience like for you when you did go to police?
For me, I was very fortunate. It was actually very positive. I've sung the praises of the guys that were of the police officers in charge of my case from the beginning. They were so supportive and really very reassuring as that I was doing the right thing. So I never once felt doubted in that support, which was kind of surprising, but it was really nice to kind of know that they had my back.
And Thomas in Suffolk Park on the text line says, when some people's heads and attitudes are stuck in the 70s, this is what you get. Annabelle, do you feel like there's any more support that can be built in for people in the workplace to handle this sort of stuff?
Look, I'll be honest, I don't think that there's an easy, quick fix to this situation. I think that it will take time and there needs to be an attitude shift for both men and women. I think women need to kind of have the faith in themselves that they can stand up for what's right and that they should feel confident. And I know easier said than done, but, you know, and it takes courage, but it's definitely good to stand up for what you think is right.
Exactly. And we've got someone else in the text line. When you accept for yourself as a manager, this is what you accept for your team. Talk us through that, Annabelle. You said you kind of wanted to lead by example in this case.
Exactly. And I think if I was in that position and I wasn't a manager and my manager had simply turned a blind eye or told me that they were regulars, I think I would have walked out on the spot.
Yeah. And do you feel like when it happened to you, you knew what to do? Do you feel like it is taught to women or men to know how to handle these situations?
No, I completely froze and just cried, to be honest. I often think back and kind of go, oh, I wish I'd just like punched him in the face or something. But for me, that was just not, you know, I just froze. So, yeah, it was really hard trying to navigate the whole system, even taking him to court and stuff. I was constantly having to figure everything out because, yeah, it's not something that you kind of get taught.
And do you feel like it has changed the culture in your workplace at all, or even the conversations people have around this sort of stuff?
I think it will take more than just me for that conversation to kind of happen. But I know that the people that I've been around, or most of them, have been incredibly supportive, and I've been so grateful for that. But I do think that it is an ongoing battle that we're facing, and I don't think that it's something that will just change overnight, unfortunately.
Absolutely. On the text line, my boss didn't kick them out because they were regulars, but I was allowed to not serve them personally. We've also got Amy on Hack's Facebook, who says, it's not just hospitality and retail workers that deal with sexual harassment. I'm a nurse, and the amount of inappropriate behaviour I see nearly every day shocks me. I worked in retail and hospitality, and nothing prepared me for this. I cannot count the amount of times I've been groped or grabbed at, not to mention people trying to kiss me. So as you said, Annabelle, a really big issue, and thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for all your support.
Thanks.
Hack.
We're at 800 capacity standing concert venue that turned into a 150 capacity cabaret venue.
On Triple J.
Do you miss live music? I know I do, with huge events like Splendor and Blues Fest postponed or cancelled. It feels like festivals as we know them are still a really long way off. So promoters have been thinking about how to get live music up and running again in the age of coronavirus. Our reporter, Hannah Loxton-Kuntz, went to a socially distanced gig over the weekend, and she takes a look at how live music is changing and how it might be for the best.
Picture this. You're in a big open field with a bunch of mates. You're all sat in armchairs in groups of five or six, and you're socially distanced from everyone else around you. Everyone gets a seat, everyone can see the band, and lining up for drinks and toilets is a thing of the past. Sounds like a pretty weird festival, right? Well, events like this are popping up around the world.
There's the main stage behind me and all of the umbrellas. Under each umbrella is a socially distant pod of six people.
Just last week, singer-songwriter Sam Fender performed for thousands of UK fans in what can only really be described as 500 mini enclosures. And Australia's following suit. I went to one on the weekend. It was the DMAs at Sydney's Factory Theatre, one of the few places around the country that started doing socially distanced gigs since the pandemic hit.
You know, it was the first time we were opening up, and we felt that they were pretty high profile shows.
That's Sam Nardo, the Chief Operating Officer at Century Venues. He's stoked with how the shows turned out, but says it took a lot of work and consideration.
It took many weeks of planning in advance, both on site and a lot of work going through all of the restriction requirements that we had. Even setting up the room, we did it multiple times before getting it what I think was just right. Needed a lot more people on board because we had COVID-safe marshals. We're doing table service. We were cleaning in between the shows.
The live music industry was the first to shut down in the pandemic and will be one of the last to emerge on the other end. That's hit artists hard. It's estimated they've lost more than $340 million in income. And while it's pretty exciting to see live music kick off again, a big part of socially distanced shows is the numbers. The amount of people at any given show has to be dramatically reduced to fit in with coronavirus restrictions. And that's got plenty of people worried we'll see ticket prices rise to compensate. For venues like the Factory Theatre, it plays a big role in how many gigs they put on.
800 capacity standing concert venue that turned into really a 150 capacity cabaret venue that was doing table service and cocktails and a lot of things that we don't normally do. If it was just one show, it just wouldn't have made sense because of all of the work that needed to go in advance. And I think a lot of other venues are experiencing that.
But the drop in numbers also has its benefits. Liz Martin is a songwriter and performer working with Accessible Arts and says the recent changes have meant people who otherwise wouldn't be able to go to gigs can now enjoy them.
For all sorts of people with all different sorts of conditions, you know, having a bit of space between so wheelchairs can navigate through a crowd is really awesome. Having a bit of distance, so perhaps people who have got a lot of anxiety as well.
Liz has been working in the space for more than 20 years. She says COVID-19 is finally forcing us to start thinking in different ways.
It's a shame that it's taken something like this to get us thinking in different ways. So it really highlights what is possible when we have a really open, creative, collaborative kind of mindset. And that's what access and inclusion is really about.
But with fewer tickets sold and a cut to the money made by artists, managers and venues, many people are asking, can a venue really keep this going long term?
The short answer to that is no. It's just not sustainable, unfortunately. These businesses are already doing it often on a knife edge anyway. So it's a really tough proposition to look at the moment and reopen it.
Liz says she's confident the changes are here to stay.
For a lot of people with disability, it's the online option is really great. And I'd love to see that continue alongside more traditional forms of gigs, I guess, at venues and so on. There's a saying in the disability community that is, if you get it right for people with disability, you get it right for everyone.
Hack. Triple J.
That was our reporter, Hannah Loxton-Kuntz there. And on the text line, we've got people. Oh, my God. I just want to go to a festival. Please go away, COVID, and make them happen soon. I am with you on that one. And text in, what do you think? Would you go to a socially distanced gig?
Hack. Q claims to be sharing insider government secrets with the masses and has spawned an entire movement, QAnon,
on Triple J.
Ever heard about this person named Q? They started that online far-right conspiracy group QAnon. Without evidence, the supporters believe US President Donald Trump is fighting a satanic deep state of global elites involved in pedophilia. Yeah, it's kind of wild, but it's gotten so big the FBI has called it a domestic terrorist threat. And Facebook is cracking down on them. We'll take a look at that in a sec, but first Stephen Stockwell is going to take you down that rabbit hole.
Ah, hello there. I've got a story that I want to tell you, but keep it quiet. It's kind of a secret.
It revolves around this one anonymous poster who's identified only by the name Q.
This is James Holloway. He is a writer and a researcher in Sydney who's been following QAnon for the last couple of years. He's going to be our guide as we slide into these dark corners of the internet.
Q claims to be an insider to the Trump administration and claims to have inside knowledge that Trump is working behind the scenes to basically shut down this elite cabal of satanic pedophiles who have been working behind the scenes, trafficking children beneath the noses of the American public for the past couple of decades.
This idea started after Donald Trump was elected. The first post was on the internet's wretched hive of scum and villainy, 4chan, before spreading across to mainstream social media. Since that first post, there have been more.
Somebody called Q has been posting in various forms, making more and more predictions.
The letter Q is important because it's the highest level of security clearance in the US and is supposed to be someone using top secret military networks to get this information out. QAnon is the name of the movement that believes in Q, even though the sides are way too conveniently drawn down political lines.
So the hero of the conspiracy is Donald Trump. In terms of who makes up this cabal, it's quite expansive, but they tend to be members of the political, financial, also liberal entertainment kind of establishment within America.
We're talking Bill and Hillary Clinton, Tom Hanks, Ellen, Oprah. It just goes on and on. James says it's hard to know how many people really believe in this, but his research has identified different waves of interest, one of which we're seeing right now. And probably because of that wave, this morning US President Donald Trump was asked about it.
Is this belief that you are secretly saving the world from this satanic cult of pedophiles and cannibals? Does that sound like something you are behind?
I haven't heard that, but is that supposed to be a bad thing or a good thing? I mean, you know, if I can help save the world from problems, I'm willing to do it. I'm willing to put myself out there.
So this thing isn't real. But that doesn't mean it's not hurting anyone.
There are people who, of course, have acted on their belief in the QAnon conspiracy.
In June 2018, a guy blocked a bridge over the Hoover Dam, demanding the release of documents to prove Q's existence. In 2019, a 24-year-old shot a mafia boss because he apparently wouldn't call for the arrest of a couple of high-profile Democrats. And earlier this year, a woman with a car full of knives had been live-streaming plans to kill presidential hopeful Joe Biden.
So there are absolutely people who have bought into this to the point where they are willing to act.
QAnon has been labelled a domestic terrorism threat by the FBI. It's played down the risk from coronavirus, and it's now seeping into the political mainstream.
So I want to tell you guys, the fake news media, the DC swamp, the political establishment tried to take me out. But there is definitely more of us than there is of them.
Last week, this woman, Marjorie Taylor Greene from Georgia, won the Republican nomination for Congress, which, given how that state votes, means she's almost guaranteed to win at the November elections. She's an open QAnon supporter.
So the arrogant fake news media, let's talk about them for a few minutes. My victory tonight should be a message to every single one of them. You don't speak for us.
Now, if you're sitting there thinking we're better than the US, just don't.
So if you go on Facebook and you know what to look for, you can find QAnon groups which are specifically for Australian and often New Zealand followers.
But now a lot of them could disappear. This morning, Facebook announced that it removed almost 800 QAnon groups, restricted hundreds of other groups and pages, and more than 10,000 Instagram accounts. And look, when it comes to believing in this, you do you. I'm a skeptical guy, and something that I think about a lot with QAnon is a woman who was interviewed for the New York Times podcast Rabbit Hole. I'm going to ruin the last episode here, so turn your radio down for a second if you're still getting through that.
Hi, this is Sam. I got out of the Q cult. So should you.
This woman is the main guest of the last episode in that series. She was a big believer in Q, watched all the YouTube videos, waited excitedly for new drops. But one day, it just fell apart for her.
What got me out was they posted Bible verses, and I just immediately knew.
Keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoice.
That it was fake. I was like, okay, let me get this straight. We're military intelligence. We've got a secret channel that we can communicate, and we're going to proselytize about the Bible and risk a military channel? No.
Hack on Triple J.
Stephen Stockwell with that report. For more on this, I am joined now by Ang Harrod-Yo, host of ABC Me's Good Game Spawn Point and a tech commentator. Rad, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, thank you. Now, Rad, talk to us. Why is Facebook cracking down on this group?
I think it's really important to recognize that a lot of people get their information from Facebook now. That's how they connect with the rest of the world. That's how they form and grow their ideas. And if the Facebook algorithm is pushing, you know, these kinds of conspiracy narratives, then it's going to radicalize people. And we've seen in the past Facebook being used as a platform for extremist content and for connecting those people and fueling that fire. So I think Facebook are more and more being kind of put under the microscope and being held to account for how they're involved or not involved in, you know, bringing these groups down.
Mm-hmm. And there are thousands of QAnon accounts out there. How hard or easy will it be for Facebook to do a crackdown on them?
Oh, that's a hard one because they can pop up so easily. And there's been new ones that have popped up that within like 3 days, they'll have tens of thousands of followers. But at the same time, they definitely will be aware of the big ones and can take those downs. But it's a bit of a game of cat and mouse.
On the text line, someone says, lost my old man to this conspiracy bullshit. Can't talk to him anymore. It sucks. Well, Rad, we're seeing how easy it is for misinformation to spread in the digital age. Is there much that governments and tech companies can do? I know we were just talking a little bit about what Facebook's trying to do, but more broadly?
It's very difficult because at the moment, tech companies are kind of absolved of any sort of media regulations, even though in this day and age, that's where most people get their media information from. So the problem is that legislation is kind of lagging behind in pulling up big tech for cases like this. And they're very much kind of self-regulated and get to do what they want and say, these are our terms of service, which can be good if the company is morally just.
Yeah. And are we seeing much of a push in places like Australia to, you know, have tech companies make a bit of a code or to have more interaction with governments to deal with stuff like this?
Well, the four big tech companies, Apple, Facebook, Amazon, and Google, just went under a antitrust hearing in U.S. Congress. So that's kind of related. They are, you know, looking at the monopoly that these companies hold and how it can potentially negatively influence people. And the ACCC in Australia has recently kind of released these guidelines in which they're trying to make sure that real news outlets have a hand up as opposed to unverified news content.
Rad, thank you so much for your tech wisdom. I'm going to bring in Professor Axel Bruns. He joins us from the Digital Research Media Centre at Queensland University of Technology. Professor Bruns, do you think deplatforming QAnon conspiracy theorists, can you actually do it? Does it work?
Look, it works to a certain point. I mean, it obviously takes some of these accounts down and disrupts, I guess, the networks. But as we've just heard, I mean, they're very quick then also to set up new accounts and come back again under different guises, perhaps in a way that isn't quite as easily detectable by Facebook and other platforms. So, yeah, it's a kind of a game of whack-a-mole, basically, where they're taken down, they're deplatformed for a while, but then probably find a way to pop up again on these platforms.
On the text line, I have a good friend who is fully obsessed with the global elite sex trade conspiracy. It's totally consuming him. I'm looking forward to the next conspiracy so he can give this one a rest. Professor Bruns, why is it that people buy into conspiracies? And is it true that more people do it during tough times?
Yeah, look, I think so, because particularly with a pandemic like we have now, with any other kind of major crisis event, of course, we end up being in the situation where there's genuinely an information vacuum, particularly early on. We don't really quite know what's going on. We don't really know where the virus came from, you know, how it's spreading, all of these things that circulated early on in the outbreak of the pandemic. So people look for answers quite legitimately. And of course, at a point when governments don't have all the answers, when mainstream media don't have all the answers, they will perhaps look a bit more broadly to these sort of fringe sites and conspiracy groups and anyone else who's got a kind of a believable opinion, perhaps even, and will perhaps get involved in that and spread that and start believing that. And that's the way that people kind of drift off into these conspiracy theories, that they're sharing rumors, particularly, yeah, when there's not a lot of really verified information out there yet.
And is there any evidence, do we know why yet this particular movement around QAnon has become so popular?
It's there's a certain game aspect to it, in a sense, because there's these drops, and you know, people can kind of wait for that and try and kind of puzzle out what it all means, if it means anything. So to some extent, it's become kind of a bit of a just a game that people play, I guess, and some people obviously get really obsessed about. And it is that kind of sense that, well, I know more than you do because I follow this, or I've been closer to unraveling all of this, to unpacking all of this, to trying to understand what's going on. So that, I think, has a real appeal to people, particularly, of course, when perhaps they're in lockdown, they haven't got much else to do as well.
And this is your specialty. Can you talk to us, why is the online world such a good place for conspiracy theorists to gain traction?
It's interesting because, of course, we've had rumors and conspiracy theories really all through the ages. They're in themselves nothing new. Again, whenever there's been a crisis throughout history, people have come up with explanations. When we had the plague in the Middle Ages, you know, people were trying to work out where that came from and thought it was an act of God or caused by particular ethnic groups or whatever. So that sort of stuff is not new. But what's new with social media, with online media more broadly, is of course that they can spread much more easily, much more quickly. They can reach much further because we're much more connected now, globally connected. And so that information travels. It travels quite quickly via media like Twitter and Facebook. And of course, you know, all of these kinds of conspiracy theories end up influencing each other as well. They're all interconnecting in some form. They're all possibly trying to outdo each other as well. And that really amplifies the visibility of all of this stuff.
And what do you think about tech platforms trying to crack down on stuff like this?
I think some of them are genuinely trying to do this, and that's to be applauded. But as we've heard, it's just very, very difficult. to do it, because, of course, the people who are doing this will end up finding ways to circumvent any of the crackdowns. If it's just a search for keywords, then, you know, they'll use other keywords and might not be so detectable.
Thank you so much, Professor Bruns, for sharing all of your knowledge with us. Rachel from Logan says, I've had to delete friends from my social media accounts due to the cult-like preaching they were sprouting. There you go. It is pretty tricky stuff when your friends get really into this, isn't it? I mean, I think we've all had our experiences of trying to talk our friends down from all of it.
Hack on Triple J.
And heaps of texts coming through about socially distanced gigs. You're saying definitely would go to a socially distanced gig. Supporting artists at a time when they aren't able to get much income. Who cares if it's socially distanced? It's still epic. Thanks for listening to the Hack podcast. I'll catch you tomorrow.